now that they've given up the living hostages, the only bargaining chips that Hamas has is its dominion and control over the 2 million Palestinians that are still living in the Gaza Strip. Hamas has achieved a high degree of terror and fear. Hamas has achieved deterrence effect of saying, this is what's going to happen to you. Look, we've spent 2 years underground. We've spent 2 years of us fighting Israel. But at the end of the day, we are still here. We're not going to disarm. We're not going anywhere. We're not accepting an international security force. And you are our hostage.
Welcome to the Miskav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons podcast, the podcast that goes beyond the headlines and the spin to give you a deeper understanding of what's really happening in the Middle East and in Israel. I'm Asher Fredman, Executive Director of the Miskav Institute for National Security and a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Normally, I'd be joined by my co-host, Lav Harkov, a Miskav Senior Fellow and the Senior Correspondent at Jewish Insider. Lav is, as we record on October 21st, covering the press conference by U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance. So she'll be back next week. Every week here on Mideast Horizons podcast, we bring you fresh insights and perspectives, not only on the most burning issues on the national security agenda in the region, but also on the incredible trends and opportunities that are taking shape in the Middle East. We invite you to subscribe and follow Mideast Horizons wherever you get your podcasts and to send your comments, your questions, your suggestions to MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. And we read all your comments, so please keep sending them. This week, at a critical moment for Israel, for Gaza, for the entire Middle East, we are joined by Ahmed Fuad Al-Khatib, a Gaza City native who today is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, where he heads the Real Line for Palestine initiative at the Atlantic Council. It seeks to challenge entrenched narratives in the Israeli and Palestinian discourse and to create a new policy framework for a rejuvenated pro-Palestinian advocacy. And his opinions, his comments, his writing has been widely covered in the American, international, and Israeli media. And in this wide-ranging conversation, we really go in depth into Gazan society, the different forces at play, those that are pro-Hamas, those that are opposed to Hamas, and just as importantly, his vision for the path forward, for the future of Gaza. And right now, as we speak, Special Envoy Witkoff, Jared Kushner are in Israel, obviously the vice president as well. And it has to be said that President Trump, Witkoff, Kushner achieved what many thought was would be impossible, which is an agreement which saw the release of the 20 living hostages who've returned to their families, the return of over half of the bodies of the murdered hostages. And of course, we continue to work and pray and demand for the return of all the murdered hostages for a proper burial in Israel. And as impossible, with Israel remaining, of course, in 53% of the Gaza Strip along the so-called yellow line, which has now been demarcated by with yellow cement blocks. And as difficult as, frankly, nearly impossible it was to achieve that first stage, we are now entering what will be even more difficult, even more complex, which is the envisioned second stage of President Trump's 20-point plan, which should see the establishment of an international stabilization force and a board of peace and a technocratic government. And we need to recall that the very first point in President Trump's 20-point plan is Gaza will be a de-radicalized, terror-free zone. Now, we've seen that Hamas appears to have no intent of giving up its arms or its control of Gaza, the parts of Gaza that it still controls that are no longer under Israeli control. And the question really is, what is the path forward? What is a realistic, pragmatic, clear-sighted path forward that takes into account the hard realities on the ground, the realities of the region, the interests of the various players, including those like Qatar and Turkey, that are aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood ideology of Hamas and have been supportive of Hamas to date. What is the path forward? And you can agree, you can disagree with Ahmed's vision and his suggestions and his policy proposals, but they are certainly worth listening to carefully. So without further ado, please stay tuned for this wide-ranging conversation with Ahmed Fuad Al-Khatib. Ahmed Fuad Al-Khatib, thank you for joining the Miskav Mideast Rises podcast. We're at a critical moment for Gaza, for Israel, for the future of the Middle East, quite frankly. So it's a great pleasure to have you on this week's episode. Can you start off just by telling for our listeners who may not be familiar a little bit about your personal background and also how the Gaza war has impacted you directly?
Well, thank you for speaking with me. It's a pleasure to connect with new audiences. So my name is Ahmed. I grew up in Gaza until the age of 15. I live in Washington, D.C. right now. And throughout my presence in the United States, which has now been 20 years long, most of my immediate and extended family remained in the Gaza Strip, in Gaza City in particular, with a significant number also living in Rafah in the south.
You grew up in which part of Gaza?
In Gaza City, in near Sheikh Radwan, very close to Sheikh Radwan and Jabalia, in Gaza City. We lived in a family building, so it's very typical over there to, you know, live in family buildings. Each uncle has a floor. There's not enough space there.
And what was that like? I mean, obviously, you know, you don't have to go into a long description, but a little bit for our listeners. What was it like growing up in Gaza, I guess, in the 90s?
Yeah, 90s and in until 2005. I left 1 month before the withdrawal of Israeli settlements, or the what's known as the disengagement. I mean, life was complex in Gaza. You know, it was a beautiful place that meant so much to its people and to its inhabitants. And it was, I was of the generation that experienced Gaza before the ubiquitous cell phone culture and ubiquitous internet and 3G and 4G. So you actually had to, you know, build friendships and connections with others. And then there is flying the kites and the beach trips and family trips and food and the culture and video games and connectivity with one another. We made beautiful memories together. But there was also the instability both within and when it came to the conflict. I experienced both the tail end of the Oslo process, and we had the Gaza International Airport. I flew into Gaza in 99 and in 2000. We had a Palestinian passport, and there was just symbols of the Palestinian state that were coming about. And then there was the Second Intifada, which was a time of turbulence, violence, instability. I saw violence both, again, from within as far as the internal instability, as well as the external violence of bombardment and tanks coming in and roads being cut out. We had two checkpoints in Gaza. We had the Netzarim checkpoint, and then we had the Gush Katif one near the old Kfar Darum settlement in there. But then in 2001, I experienced a very traumatic near-death experience in which I lost two of my friends who were killed, and I lost a significant amount of hearing in my left ear. But that, because I was near a bombing, an F-16 bombing that was very close to me and really shook me to my core, but also convinced me that I really needed to leave the Gaza Strip. And that's when I began really investing in learning English and focusing on English as a tool for leaving the Gaza Strip. And 4 years later, I headed to the United States as a high school exchange student, part of a new program to live with a host family for a year and then go back, hopefully a year later, to Gaza. I did that, but unfortunately, when I was about to go back to Gaza in 2006, after the program was finished, Hamas abducted Gilad Shalit, a young Israeli soldier, and there was a mini war, the Lebanon War, and then thankfully I was able to return back to the U.S. with the support of human rights and peace activists, and I applied for political asylum status. And on the very day of my asylum interview was June 14th, 2007, which is the very day that Hamas violently took over the Gaza Strip. So I was the first of a wave of Palestinians from Gaza who got asylum in the United States because of Hamas's control.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I remember the scenes of Hamas throwing its opponents mm-hmm. off of rooftops. Mm-hmm. And it was a very quick and, I guess, deadly battle, right? I think it was in 6 days, Hamas managed to take over the Gaza Strip and essentially expel the Palestinian Authority. And many of the PA representatives fled to Israel, fled to Egypt. That was obviously a very, very dramatic moment.
Precisely. Now,
taking fast forward, so I know you still have some family members left in Gaza. I've heard you mention your brother, who I think is in Gaza currently. And can you say a little bit about how this war has impacted you and your family?
Certainly. So unfortunately, on October 13th, October 25th, and December 14th of 2023, there were three separate Israeli airstrikes that destroyed my family home where I grew up, destroyed my second home in Rafah, where I was there every weekend. That was my mom's family. That was entirely wiped out. This first strike decimated our household. The one in Rafah killed the entirety of my mom's family. I lost over 34 of my immediate and extended family members. And since then, there were several, I lost several first cousins on both sides of my family. I was able to, thankfully, my mom is, I was able to get several folks out of Gaza. My mom is out. My brother's wife is out of Gaza, and so are his four kids. He decided to stay behind because he runs the field operations for a major international medical NGO. And he has really seen some of the worst of the war, as well as now that it's over, he's also seen temporarily over. I hope it's permanently over. But throughout the war, he's also seen the crime, the lawlessness, Hamas, their behavior, the disintegration of Palestinian society as a result of Hamas's continued control and of the war. And the same is true with my surviving aunts and uncles, first aunts and uncles, most of whom, actually all of whom, are homeless in tents and very severely ill. And so it's very tragic. It's very horrendous what has happened to them for no fault of their own. And I have strong relations in with Israeli folks and groups and individuals and members of the political class. And I've asked to find out why, what happened on those airstrikes. I've asked for explanations and given details, given coordinates, given precise information, and never really received anything, any details whatsoever as to why my family, like, you know, tens of thousands of people, have paid the ultimate price.
And I think it's very important. This is also in my many conversations with whether it's student groups or politicians. You know, I often say, you know, you could talk about what caused the war, but who's to blame, what the solutions are, how we move forward. But the scale of the destruction, the human suffering, should be recognized by all. That shouldn't be controversial. That, you know, there are many, many people who paid the price for the war and whose lives were destroyed by the war. And I guess beyond the tragedy, which is obviously very, very great, it also gives you, I would say, you know, it's hard for me to say, but a lot of skin in the game, right? In your advocacy for what it looks like, you're not sitting on the, sort of an armchair. It's people who you've experienced, what your family is currently experiencing, that really will be impacted by how events develop today, tomorrow, over the next week, and over the next months. Could you tell us a little bit about what's actually happening in Gaza now. So we're 11 days after the ceasefire has come into effect. Obviously, many people have seen the videos of Hamas retribution, of Hamas beating people. There are reports of people coming back from the Amawas to the humanitarian area, returning to Gaza City. What do you hear? What do you hear from your brother, from others that you're in contact with? What's actually happening on the ground? Because you can't believe everything you see on X.
Certainly. And I mean, long before the war, 10 years ago, I tried to build an internationally run Israeli-approved airfield in the Gaza Strip. And that got me a huge amount of contacts in the Gaza Strip that I was able to leverage over time. And so beyond my family and my brother and others, there's just an army of friends and allies there across the Gaza Strip. And so there are really multiple threads happening right now. You have the continuation of the suffering that should come as no surprise. Gaza's humanitarian conditions are awful and horrendous. Most of the population are living in the Hamas-controlled area over the so-called yellow line that was established as part of phase one of the ceasefire deal.
I think that's an important point for people to realize, despite the fact that I think something like 53% of the territory remains under IDF control, approximately 80% of the population is on the side that's under Hamas control, essentially.
Precisely that. And they're very concentrated in the central and southern parts in very specific areas with very high density, never designed or meant to have that many people living in them. And so you have that element. You have Hamas reemerging in a variety of ways. Some of them came out of the tunnels. Many of them came out of the hospitals, the tents, the humanitarian shelters, all the different areas that they were hiding in. And, you know, I'm sure somebody's going to look at this clip and say, oh my God, Ahmed is justifying the killing of his own people. Absolutely not. I have been saying this, the people of Gaza have been saying this the whole time of the war, that Hamas has unfortunately given itself the right to exist in any piece of Gaza, any space that it sees fit. We've seen them digging for Israeli hostages, the deceased ones, under the massive number of residential towers and apartments. This is documented beyond the dispute. And yet you still have many in Western press or the elements of the pro-Palestine movement, unfortunately, that are refusing to acknowledge this. And they're like, no, Ahmed, this is Hasbara. Ahmed, this is Israeli propaganda. Ahmed, why are you repeating Israeli talking points? Well, see for yourself, you know? And so that's one angle. The other angle is that we've had Hamas both go on a rampage to reassert its control. And that meant going after the only real substantive threat to its presence in the Gaza Strip, and that's the clans. So who are the clans? Two-thirds of Gaza's population are refugees or descendants of refugees from 1948. Those are people that have the UNRWA cards, UNRWA being the UN agency with schools, medical facilities, etc. And one-third of Gaza's population are considered natives. Those are people that lived in Gaza before 1948. And of this one-third, the natives, you have the Bedouins, or you have the tribes, or the clans. The clans are people like Abu Amra, Hellis, Dogmush, Tarabin, and many other big names that historically tended to own more property, more land. They tended to have more social clout. They tended to have more political influence. And they also tended to have a lot of guns historically. Just like a lot of Arab Bedouins across the Middle East or Arab tribes in Iraq and in Jordan and Northern Sinai and the Arabian Peninsula. Add to that is that Hamas, most of their fighters and most of their leadership, they are not from the clans. They are from the refugees, the two other thirds, the refugee camps, the UNRWA camps, they tend to... So when I say this, by the way, while it is true that there is, you know, they're all Gazans, there's very much so a system of social stratas. There is, like, when I grew up in Gaza, and even to this day, in a sense, or right before the war, let's say, when you meet another Gazan, within a brand new Gazan, within the first hour, at some point in the conversation, it's going to come up, where are you from? And it's not, where are you living? But it's like, where are you from, historic Palestine, or are you a Gazan? It is basically an immediate component. You have people who are refugees and people who are natives. For the longest time, it's still not, there's not a whole lot of intermarrying, because people, again, like, there's resentment, for example, before, in the past, only the 2/3 refugees, even when Gaza was under blockade, restrictions, poverty, only the 2/3 would access UNRWA services, mm-hmm. but the poor 1/3 native Gazans, they're not all rich. A lot of them are very extremely poor people, but because they're not refugees, they didn't access the aid. So that created a lot of friction and a lot of resentment.
It seems like Hamas has relatively easily been able to reestablish its dominance over the clans. Is that correct? Or is it, has the fighting been more intense and perhaps more, even-handed or you know, equivocal in terms of the outcome than what it appears?
Apologies for the earlier prolonged context, but I felt that that's very important. But because a lot of people are not really, when you hear clans, it's an abstract concept. It's like, well, you know. So in the war, the Israeli government really was interested in working with some of these clans, many of whom, by the way, refused because they didn't want to participate in the Israeli war and be working with the IDF. Some of them felt that it is inevitable that Hamas will reemerge. Some of them were concerned that they're being set up for failure. And some of them just were adopting a wait-and-see approach. So Hamas, after it emerged, it used a broad umbrella of fighting collaborators and fighting crime. It set the scene and said, we are now going to restore law and order. How are you going to do that, Hamas? By going after the collaborators and going after the criminals. Now, unfortunately, of course, that became a Soviet-style charge that Hamas's commissars would simply and loosely apply to anyone.
Right, there's no due process, right? It's like, you know, we think you're a collaborator, we're going to take you out on the street and beat you or shoot you, right?
Hamas, very sadly, did just that, and they have dominated all of the clans in the Gaza Strip. One of the clans, the Al-Majaida, was able to work with one of the anti-Hamas militias led by Hussam al-Astal, and they received air support from the IDF on October 3rd, and they actually beat back Hamas. But without IDF air support, without on-the-ground presence, unfortunately, Hamas is ultimately able to reign supreme because they have a lot of ferocious fighters, but also they have a lot of ammunition, a lot of the RPGs, they have mortars, and they have drones for surveillance. They can take pictures. Mm-hmm. And so the clans thus far, Hamas has been successful since the ceasefire 11 days ago in silencing the clans, getting some of them to disarm, silencing a lot of my friends and contacts and opposition people in Gaza, who ironically, they felt much, I mean, I'm not, again, people are going to clip this video and say, oh my God, look at Ahmed. He wants the war back. Ironically, my friends, many of them felt safer writing their true opinions of Hamas on Facebook, on Twitter, on social media during the war than they do right now. After the ceasefire, they actually all kind of went underground and are staying quiet. because now that Hamas is back up, before Hamas was a lot more worried about surviving and being in tunnels and whatever. They still terrorize people, but now Hamas has succeeded in silencing a large number of Gazans. They got the clans. They have gone after some of the organized crime.
If I'm not mistaken, I think that Steve Witkoff, I think, said this in the 60 Minutes interview, was that the United States asked Israel not to intervene in Hamas's attacks against these clans after the ceasefire, not on October 3rd, but once the ceasefire came into effect on October 10th, because they wanted essentially the war to end. They didn't want Israel acting militarily over the yellow line. So there may be cases where Israel could have supported these clans in their fight against Hamas, but there may have been American pressure to prevent them from doing so.
And I believe that wholeheartedly, and we saw that expressed in the statements of President Trump when on two separate occasions, he basically said, we allowed them to temporarily do this. And then he said, it didn't bother me, to be honest. Like, they were going after very bad gangs. And again, there's two separate issues. It is true that there's gangs and looters and terrible players that exploited. That's true in any war, in Iraq after 2003, in Haiti, in Libya, in Yemen, and multiple scenes of violence and war. But what Hamas did is it attempted to use the idea, the aura of restoring law and order to say, oh, look, we're working to restore law and order, but they snuck in there the elimination, basically, of all of their opposition.
If you had to give obviously it's just a rough estimate, but if you had to give a rough estimate of how many people Hamas has either murdered or beaten and injured in this wave of retribution or the restoration of law and order, depending on how you frame it, how many Gazans would you say have suffered at the hands of Hamas over the last 11 days? So tens, hundreds?
Well, definitely in the hundreds, but here's what's interesting. I mean, unlike the numbers that we hear about regularly when Israel was bombing, in which you would get numbers right away, when Israel struck back after the ceasefire violation 2 days ago, you got the number immediately that 21 Palestinians were killed. Somehow, when it comes to the opposition to Hamas and their terror,
the Gazan Health Ministry all of a sudden doesn't have the information.
There is zero information. Some of that is, you know, they don't, the way they count people. Some of that is a lot of those people that are killed or harmed, they get neglected. They don't get counted as casualties of the war. They don't get input into the system. Some people just take the dead ones to burial immediately without taking them to hospitals. So the system itself, there's no way to tabulate the number of wounded. And like you said, the Gaza Health Ministry is all of a sudden quite absent because those are not numbers that we want out. So I have seen wild, wild estimates online. And I have kind of given up on trying to estimate it because basically you have to tabulate eyewitness testimonies. And I kept track with extensive things here, but I gave up after a while. Or you have to basically rely on secondhand accounts. And those are notoriously difficult to verify. I've seen numbers as low as 100 and as high as 210, 240, 230. I've seen claims of upward of 4 to 450. Again, these are just all over the place. And I've seen them mostly on Telegram, Twitter, and Arabic-speaking Facebook accounts from Palestinians in Gaza. Nevertheless, the end result and the outcome is the same, which is that Hamas has achieved a high degree of terror and fear. Hamas has achieved kind of this deterrence effect of saying, this is what's going to happen to you. Look, we've spent 2 years underground. We've spent 2 years of us fighting Israel. But at the end of the day, we are still here. We're not going to disarm. We're not going anywhere. We're not accepting an international security force. And you are our hostage. That is literally what Hamas is doing and saying effectively is, those of you Palestinians over the yellow line, you belong to us. You're our, now that they've given up the living hostages, The only bargaining chips that Hamas has is its dominion and control over the 2 million Palestinians that are still living in the Gaza Strip.
Wow. But I actually want to get back to the point about Hamas disarming or not disarming. But before that, I want to ask you regarding the degree of support that Hamas enjoys in the Gaza Strip. I've heard you say that it's a very low level of support. But according to the best available Palestinian polling that we have, the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research, Dr. Khalid Shikaki, his latest polling, which is from May 2025, so before the ceasefire, but 19 months after the October 7th attack, he found that among Gazans, when they were asked which political party they supported the most, Hamas enjoyed a strong plurality. 37% supported Hamas. I think something like 25% supported Fatah. 23% supported other parties, which could include Islamic Jihad or other Islamist parties. When he asked Gazans, do you support disarming Hamas in order to bring about an end to the war? 64% said they opposed disarming Hamas. And when he asked them whether they thought that the decision to launch the October 7th attack was the right decision, 37% said they thought that was the right decision. In the Gaza, about 59% in the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank thought that it was the right decision. So obviously there's a difference there because the Palestinians in the West Bank haven't suffered like the Palestinians in Gaza. But it definitely seems like, and in some ways it's not surprising because Hamas took over the Gaza Strip 18 years ago. The median age in Gaza is 18. So half the Gazan population has grown up under Hamas domination, Hamas schools, Hamas mosques, Hamas media. So what do you think really is the level of support for Hamas among Gazans?
Certainly. And I have spoken about this ad nauseum. I mean, I am personally of the view that you cannot do, I mean, we just spent, you know, what, like the better part of almost half an hour or 20 minutes talking about Hamas beating, torturing, jailing oppositions and disappearing them. Like, Gaza is not a free society. It is not a democratic society. You cannot credibly and meaningfully do polling in there, just like you cannot really incredibly do polling in North Korea or in Russia or in Iran or elsewhere. There's a whole culture around how you even answer questions and how people tell you what they think you want to hear. There is a whole kind of mixing of the different files. Like when people heard, and by the way, I'm not denying that Hamas has a group of people that are brainwashed and that need to be de-radicalized and that need a new school of thought and that need new alternatives. And yes, to build upon your point, I want to add another number there, which is that something like over 70% of Gazans have never left or traveled outside of the Gaza Strip. Most don't have a passport. Most haven't seen the outside world, except on their phone screens. And so, contextually speaking, of course Hamas is going to have support. Then there's the idea, but you have to like pull the different threads to understand that. But before you understand the threads and attempt to it, I wholeheartedly believe that these polls are inaccurate. I do not for a second believe that they are free of intimidation. I do not for a second believe that Hamas does not manipulate them directly and indirectly. And we saw last August, a year from something like 13 months ago, the IDF itself published documents, and I wrote a piece about it then, showing how Hamas manipulated the results of these of Shikaki's polls that showed how that inflated support for the group. And why is it that Hamas before October 7th, the Arab Barometer, and why is it that a host of other like Zubby's research services, which just did several for the Tony Blair Institute, found that Hamas only 7 to 9% of Palestinians wanted Hamas to remain in Gaza after the war? There is just massive inconsistencies when other pollsters do their polling versus when Khalil Shikaki does his polling that relies to an indirect degree on access that Hamas knows about. So I maintain wholeheartedly that these are not as reliable as the entire world or elements of the world makes them out to be. And again, the IDF itself said so a year ago and showed documents of how Hamas manipulated those. And then the little bit, assuming that, fine, there's a margin that has been manipulated, but even the raw data itself or the quote-unquote accurate part of the data itself shows problematic tendencies, even that, I think you can pull apart different threads. When people heard disarm Hamas, they might have thought that this means there's no police, there's no law and order, and that there would be complete dominion by Israel over their life, and that the criminals and the gangsters would run amok in Gaza society. When they heard disarm Hamas, there is very much so a difference between the broad idea and narrative of, and this is something, by the way, that Hamas itself does. Hamas postures that even if you don't like us as Hamas, as an entity, as a political group, you should still like the idea of resistance, which, by the way, we Hamas represent the resistance. Because Hamas, a lot of times, they don't refer to themselves as Hamas. They refer to themselves as the resistance. So Hamas is both Hamas, the political group, and Hamas, the resistance. So that's a very key linguistic, but socio-political context that is very key.
Mukawama,
exactly. So that's why, like, when I talk about the process of de-radicalization, which is a process, it's not just like an on-off switch, and you can't just lecture people and say, you're radical, de-radicalized, boom. My thing is, there are plenty of Palestinians that are genuinely ready to move. There's a window whereby enough Palestinians are ready to move from the armed resistance narrative to the nation-building narrative, to from the resistance narrative to the coexistence narrative. And that doesn't mean they're Zionist or they love Israel overnight, okay? But it means that the first step in the 100 or 5 or 1,000 mile journey can be taken right now with rejuvenation, economic development, the restoration of life and dignity and basic needs, but also the pushing out of Hamas, of their weapons, of their narratives, out of the scene, but then rapidly filling that with something else. So that's where you can pull, and just real quickly on the, like, who supports Hamas? It's just like an onion. There's a core of an ideological support, and then you peel at that. Hamas created a network of patronage. All those fighters in Gaza right now, they get paid like $25 a day, $25 a day. Before the war, same. The average salary of a Nukba force was something like, a Nukba fighter was something like $300 to $500 a month. Then you have the Hamas, the government, that created positions, and the Qataris were paying for those positions, and cars, and access to public lands, and access to taxes, and you could tax the heck out of people. And then you had people on the side that were representatives in Qatar, in Turkey, in Malaysia, in South Africa, in Algeria. Hamas had relations, foreign relations, with all of these different countries. And so, and then you had people that were like, they were getting little crumbs, and then, and so on and so forth. Similarly, those who oppose Hamas, you have ideological opponents of Hamas. You have people that fundamentally hate Hamas. You have people that hate it just because they're secular. They want to drink alcohol. They want to do their secular business. Then you have young people that want a better future. Then you have people that don't want to waste their lives away while Hamas leaders are getting overweight in Doha and Qatar and Turkey. Then you have people that see the failures. You see, it's not just the failures of the war and October 7 and the disaster, but it's almost the last 18 years, like almost the last two decades. So October 7th and the destruction of Gaza is the icing on the cake of all those failures. So that's why, just to conclude, there's a lot more I wish, you know, I cannot tell you how many times I get comments on social media, questions, and I wish that Israelis, Jewish community, self-identified Zionists, or just casual observers would. That's why I'm sharing this with a lot of detail, is that there's really a lot more than just this artificial and raw number that you see. And you're like, wow, these people are hopeless. After years, 2 years of war, they're still thinking this. When again, all of the aforementioned goes in it, and the reality is really much more complicated.
I think I appreciate that. And that's really one of the goals of the Mideast Horizons podcast, is to go beyond the headlines and the slogans and to, you know, bring a deeper understanding of what's really happening in Israel, in the Middle East, to our listeners. So say thank you for that. I want to go back to something you said before, which was that Hamas isn't going to disarm. And I certainly agree that Hamas is not going to disarm voluntarily. And I think their actions over the last 11 days or 2 weeks have shown that very clearly. My question to you is, can you conceive of an Arab or Muslim force, whether it's Indonesian or Qatari or Azerbaijan or Emirati or Egyptian, any other Arab or Muslim force that goes in and with force disarms, takes away the arms of Hamas, goes into their weapons hideouts and their storage and into the tunnels and actually removes the weapons that they're not willing to give up?
So this is where I have been very critical of how this should have been done before the ceasefire was even implemented. So that while the ceasefire, as soon as the ceasefire went in effect, this force goes in and at least establishes a beachhead. This is where there needs to be a decision, a mandate authorized by the international community and the UN Security Council. It needs to give legal and liability cover and protection for participants of this force to protect them from any legal liability. And what do I mean by that? If they're going to, you know how insane some members of the pro-Palestine movement are. If they're going to shoot a bunch of Hamas guys because they raised weapons or they got in a shootout with them, are the pro-Hamas guys going to start yelling, you know, Azerbaijan is committing genocide against the Palestinians? Are they going to say...
The answer is yes. They're going to start saying that.
Or are they going to say Indonesia is committing genocide against the Palestinians? So they can say that, but if Azerbaijan and Indonesia and Malaysia, if they have a solid authorization for the use of force, for the examples of when to use that force, if they are exempt from any legal liability, if they have the encouragement to proactively, not reactively, proactively go and seek out Hamas hideouts, the tunnels, the spaces where the guns and the munitions are, then this force has a chance. Otherwise, we're going to be stuck with a UNIFIL situation in southern Lebanon, where Hezbollah quadrupled in strength and number as the force is there. The force ended up protecting Hezbollah, not disarming it. So that's what we cannot allow that. My concern is that Qatar should not shape the future of this force. My concern is that we end up with, there's two types of force. There's the peacekeeping force, and then there's the stabilization force, which is something that kind of needs to be invented, if you will, because it's going to have a hybrid element. It has to have teeth. It has to have power. It has to have a strike component. It has to go out and hit Hamas, if need be. I'm not saying, like, it has to have an aggressive component to it. And that's not because I want them to declare war on Gaza. I'm just saying that if they're standing there and all of a sudden they see a Hamas cell, they go up to that cell and say, hey, who are you? What are you doing? All right, well, we need you to come with us, or we need, why are you carrying all these guns? Boom, boom, boom. You try to de-escalate, boom, boom. If not, then we're going to surround you. We're going to arrest you. If not, we're going to shoot you. That's what's needed. That's the only way you take on Hamas. That's how the Palestinians... it did it in the past, the Palestinian Authority. The other thing, too, is that this force needs to have an auxiliary Palestinian element to it. and that is Palestinian, it could be elements of the Palestinian Authority. And I'm not saying we bring all the PA to Gaza. I'm simply saying we bring an element of Palestinian security forces. We professionalize a group of different clans. We mix them together, though. We don't just say this clan, this guy. We bring this clan, boom, we recruit. We mix them together. We train them. We professionalize them. We give them uniforms. And we say, go out as part of the patrol with this force. You know the terrain. You know the areas. You know Hamas members. We need an intelligence apparatus. We need informants. We need surveillance. We need info. Like this, if we're complaining that the IDF, which I have issues with the IDF and how they went about the war, applying too much force, you're killing Hamas opponents and supporters alike. I want a surgical approach to this war, to this conflict. But that means there's still a war to be fought against Hamas if they don't choose to disarm, if they don't choose to integrate, to de-radicalize and to integrate in a new future.
I'll tell you what I'm concerned about. I'm concerned that there's a declaration under this International Stabilization Force that we are establishing the Gazan General Security Agency, and it'll say in the founding document that this agency just protects law and order and will counter extremism. And then the Hamas fighters sort of all sign up, they hand in their Hamas Kalashnikovs and they get a Gaza Security Force Kalashnikov. There is an explanation that, hey, they've joined this force that says that they're going to combat extremism, that they're only interested in law and order. And they'll start getting salaries, Qatari-funded salaries, internationally-funded salaries for being members of this new security force. And hey, they even handed in their guns, and now they got you know, sort of guns that we know the numbers of. We know the serial numbers of each of those guns. And essentially, what you'll have is you'll have these former, essentially current Hamas troops now being sort of whitewashed, now being legitimized, and to be receiving a salary, continue to be armed. And when Hamas decides that it's ready once again, it'll be able to use those forces to carry out the next attack against Israel or against their opponents in the Gaza Strip.
It's very interesting you bring that up, because I very much so believe that is the Qatari plan, and that's why they've had them not wear uniforms. Hamas fighters, they've had them remain in civilian clothes. I very much so believe that there is a plan on the horizon to recycle elements of Hamas's security, of Hamas's fighting apparatus and security. Because remember, we're talking about Qassam brigades and the fighters and the terrorist guys where the Nukba is and blah, blah, blah. And then we're talking about Hamas has its own governmental internal security, police force, traffic police, etc., etc. A year ago, actually a year and a half ago, I wrote a paper in which I envisioned what would it look like to recycle elements of Hamas into a new force. I've studied intelligence and national security. I am not fundamentally opposed to the idea of recycling those who accept, who de-radicalize and accept a peaceful framework for moving forward as part of the future. Because we don't want to repeat the same mistake of de-Ba'athification, where you had a lot of Iraqi troops out of jobs, and those are, you know, experienced fighters and soldiers, often with guns, who were pushed out, and then they became insurgents.
But what would de-radicalization look like in that case? What would be the process, and how would you know that somebody has been de-radicalized?
So that would be a series of professionalized courses, trainings, opening up and well-documented, transparent steps that they engage in, a well-rounded program that has been done before, that has been undertaken. And the United Arab Emirates did that. You know who did that really well, ironically, before the regime collapsed? Was Libya's Muammar Gaddafi. Before 2011, Libya's Gaddafi was actually kind of an example of like a role model, if you will, of successful de-radicalization that can really work out until, of course, then the intervention in 2011. So what I'm trying to say is, my concern then becomes, how do you de-link? It's not just the de-radicalization, it's the de-linking of ideology and of the connection with Hamas. If Hamas stays as a mere idea in people's head, that's one thing. But if Hamas has a loose command structure that can be activated, that's where you need counterintelligence. That's where you need internal affairs. That's where you need continuous vetting and monitoring. And by the way, in the United States, for example, we have this continuous vetting, which is part of the cleared workforce. We have millions. We have something like 2 to 3 million workers in the United States who hold top secret, various levels of security clearances, from secret, top secret, top secret, with sensitive compartmented access or information. And there's a process of continuous vetting different inputs for each one of these people, their social media feeds, their credit reports, their criminal records, different tips and informations. So you can do continuous monitoring and vetting, and you can do counterintelligence to detect attempts at penetration, the insider threat, etc. That is a solvable problem. But the issue is, it cannot be entirely made up, this force of Hamas members. You need external intervention. You need new Palestinians who are not part of any security operation. You need a new, what I've been calling a new generation of security and law enforcement professionals. Now, whether we like it or not, it is a fact that there are some key Hamas security personnel. If they were to truly de-radicalize, and these are not people that are really involved in heinous crimes, Gaza and we in this process would benefit immensely from their expertise, in the sense that these are battle-hardened. These are people that are not afraid to be shot at. These are people that know the terrain. These are people that have just the have experience. It's kind of like, why is it that, you know, in a lot of the private military defense sector, you use a lot of ex-special forces because they're experienced and they're fearless warriors. So that's where we can do that. But going back to the force itself, which is what has to be the first step, is a reliance on the force. And then you slowly integrate Palestinian elements, an external force with Palestinian elements.
So let me ask you, you know, I'm sure you, like, you obviously read the 20-point plan and following closely the statements by the president and by Jared Kushner and by Steve Witkoff and others. And by the way, I do want to say something. You know, there's been a criticism of some of the things that Jared has said, that Steve Witkoff has said. But the fact is that they did get the first stage of the 20-point plan through. The 20 living hostages came out. A number, more than half, I believe, of the murdered hostages have been released, with Israel still remaining in 53% of Gaza. And that is an outcome that I think nobody would have thought possible. If we go back a few years, Jared led the efforts on the Abraham Accords, again, another accomplishment that nobody thought was possible. So I do think that, together with, you know, the questions or skepticism that people are raising about stage two, the next stage, this future vision, in some ways I certainly think that their intentions are obviously very, very good, and their ability to achieve things that were considered impossible, at least they should be given a chance, should be given the benefit of the doubt, while we also track very closely what is actually happening on the ground, what Hamas is doing, and how things are progressing. That's just my personal view. If you had, Ahmed, if you had a minute to sit with President Trump, what would you be your message to him? What's the most important message that you think the U.S. administration needs to understand with regards to Gaza?
I would say, keep up the pressure on Qatar and Turkey to keep Hamas in check, to keep Hamas in line with what they had agreed to, whip up support for the International Stabilization Force. The world is looking to U.S. leadership. And while we're not going to shoulder the financial burden of what's unfolding in Gaza, the international community is very much waiting for the United States to act. Nobody is going to step forward without clear U.S. leadership. And so pressure on those who can control Hamas, U.S. leadership on the international force, and inspiration for the people of Gaza to feel that they are a part of making their future. You know, a lot of people in Gaza, they're demoralized, they're hopeless. They have been a political football between Iran and Qatar and the Muslim Brotherhood and the PA and Hamas and all these different players and Netanyahu's government, etc. And so there's finally an opportunity here, I think, to address the people of Gaza, really, just as President Trump had addressed Israel and the Israeli people at the Knesset, to promise a different path forward if they collectively engage with this process that will reap benefits for themselves and their families.
As a final question, you are a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and you head the Realign for Palestine project or initiative. Could you tell us a little bit about what the Realign for Palestine initiative is and what its goals are?
Well, so it's an initiative that really has two parallel tracks. After, you know, a year and a half of me since October 7 doing what I was doing of writing, speaking out publicly, doing social media, going to events and conferences and working with Israelis and hostage families and trying to break away from the vicious cycle of hatred, incitement, violence, revenge, rinse and repeat as a way to honor the legacy of my fallen family members, I decided that I want to create something that's a little bit bigger than just what Ahmed has to say in hopes of truly inspiring other Palestinians to courageously come forth and feel that they're not alone, because there are many who privately will tell me, Ahmed, I appreciate what you're doing. Thank God someone else is saying what we know is true, but we can't say so publicly, or we're afraid to say so publicly, or we're too fearful and intimidated. So there are two tracks to Realign for Palestine, which as much as it's a project, it's also a framework. It's a philosophy. It's a way of thinking. The first is narrative work, and the second is policy work. As far as the narrative work, I aim and hope to redefine what it means to be pro-Palestine. What does it mean to be Palestinian? Really do a lot of work in moving the narrative away from the armed resistance one to the nation building focus. Challenge the entrenchment of extremism on all sides, and certainly on the Israeli side. Even though I'm focused on the Palestinian community and the Palestinian side, and particularly on Gaza, my thesis is that while there's asymmetry in the power dynamics between Israel and Palestinians, there is plenty of space within said imbalance for Palestinian agency, responsibility, and accountability, and to make different decisions that optimize for a better outcome. And that's not blaming the victim or self-hating, being self-hating. That's actually the first tool, the first step to empowering the Palestinian people, in my view. And so that's a lot of the narrative work, and that extends to relations with self-identified Zionists and dialogue and conversations, radical pragmatism, the renunciation of violence, the embrace of the idea of multiple truths.
Which is a great phrase, radical pragmatism. I think that's a great and very appropriate phrase to describe, in general, the situation now.
Precisely that, and the embrace of the two-nation solution, that regardless of the specific borders, the idea is that there are two peoples, two nations, in which they, and two separate spaces in which they express their unique national identities. So that's on the narrative side. And then on the policy side, it does adopt a Gaza-first approach, in the sense that Gaza can and should become the role model of effective Palestinian self-governance, the crown jewel, if you will, of the Palestinian people, and what an occupation, military occupation free West Bank can look like, so that you can have a federated Palestinian state in Gaza and in the West Bank. You can have Gaza becoming the nexus for Palestinian development, an artificial peninsula that has an airport and a seaport, the IMEC corridor, making Gaza a central node, Gaza being the connectivity of Gaza and its people to the outside world, beyond just the unhealthy codependency on Egypt or Israel. That, to me, is what radical pragmatism entails. And some of that is envisioned through the transitional period after the war and post-Hamas, hopefully. And some of that is more long-term. And so it's not just economic peace, but it's economic development, peace, and prosperity coupled with a renaissance and a rejuvenation, a mental one and a physical and geospatial one that brings together the best minds to really transform the Gaza Strip. And that's what I hope Realign for Palestine does, is it realigns the priorities, the talents, our thoughts, our speech with our actions, and in true service of the Palestinian people, so that we are actually truly pro-Palestine and not simply using empty sloganeering and rhetoric.
And I think that could be very valuable. I was very involved, I know it's a different context, but very involved in building sort of the grassroots Abraham Accords ties at the very outset. And the challenge I find with the Israeli-Palestinian dialogue is that often it either ends up to be, you know, either mutual demonization or sort of one-sided demonization or a recounting of grievances. And all those exist and are legitimate, and people have suffered unspeakable tragedies. But if we could bring together, in my view, if we could bring together Israelis and Gazans, Israelis and Palestinians, for conversations that are very much focused on building a constructive future. They're not ignoring the past, but the focus is, okay, how do we move forward together in a way that's constructive for both peoples, even putting aside the contours of a political settlement. But okay, like you were saying, peace and prosperity and renaissance and mutual growth and the ability for both peoples to flourish and develop, I think that could be very, very valuable. I certainly would be very informative. I'm sure that people who listen to this podcast will have learned quite a lot about, not just about what's happening now in the news, but about Gaza in general and the Gazan society and the complexities in Gazan society. So thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. And I look forward to continuing the dialogue.
Inshallah. Thank you so much for speaking with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. Make sure to subscribe, like, and follow the Miskav Institute at www.miskavins.org. And of course, to subscribe and like us across all social media and podcast platforms. And send your comments and questions to MideasthorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. That's MideasthorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. And we'll see you next time.